move to the next case of the morning, which is Angelita Rabiscus versus Universities Research Association.
Oh God.
Mr. Doar.
How are you? Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel. My name is John Doar, D-O-R-E. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Angelita Rabiscus. There are some typographical errors in the brief that hopefully the panel will overlook. Subject matter of the brief on behalf of the appellant is basically unchallenged in the response brief on behalf of the defendant. As to the specific subjects, lack of jurisdiction by the trial court. Lack of subject matter jurisdiction as an absolute determinant is shown by the fact that the trial court, in an effort to establish potential criminal conduct, vested itself with arbitrary and unreasonable authority to conduct an investigation with the potential application of a criminal penalty.
Mr. Doar, when you argue that there was no evidence that Ms. Gravisky's engaged in fraud or criminal conduct in conjunction with the federal lawsuit, are you arguing that the conduct related instead to the state suit?
No.
In which her husband was representing her?
No. I think my argument is consistent. It may not have been articulated as well as could be expected. My point was, and it continues to be my point, once there was an observation of potential criminal conduct, neither the state court nor the trial court could become involved, because the standards, as I understand it, would apply to both proceedings, that it could not be neither the state court nor the federal court could become involved with the circumstance as an investigative tool, as an investigative responsibility. There was a complete line of demarcation, Your Honor. The second aspect of that was, as I pointed out in the subject matter circumstance, there was absolutely nothing that was before the federal trial court, and I'd have to believe with regard to the state court, that in any way would have been affected by whatever the alleged conduct was. It was surely not involved, and this is not refuted, surely not involved in a motion for summary judgment, which I had undertaken.
Even though she used information that was obtained in discovery in a federal lawsuit, including Terry Erickson's signature and Social Security number, employee ID, and the memo to personnel used the name of her attorney in the federal suit?
Your Honor, I don't know that as an absolute fact. I do not know that. That's what the trial court determined based upon the negative inferences. But as I pointed out, there are so many arguments against that as a reasonable possibility that it should have been persuasive the other way. There are approximately 1,550 pieces of information, of documents, that I was aware of that were presented on behalf of the defendant in response to the request to produce under Rule 26. To this day, I don't know all the documents that were there. I couldn't tell you, as a matter of circumstances, as to what the content of all those documents were. So it is, in my opinion, very unreasonable to make that suggestion, that this was effectively an abuse of discovery. That's not a circumstance, I believe, that could be well-founded and taken by the trial court.
What is it's your objection that this thing got totally sidetracked on a on an issue that doesn't have anything to do with the case? What is the point?
That is the further point.
Well, what is the judge supposed to do?
As I had additionally recommended to the trial court, that if the court felt, based upon what was being presented, that there was potential criminal conduct, then that circumstance should have been taken out and placed in the hands of some sort of criminal investigative authority.
So what, do you put the case on hold or just go right ahead and try the case on the, some kind of discrimination?
The motion for summary judgment had been pending. My brief was due and I responded. That was the subject matter before the court.
Well, how much control did you have over the case versus, I guess, Mr. Graviscus, who seems to be in and out of this as a lawyer, I guess, representing her in another case and obviously seemed to be pretty much involved in this one? This would, at least with regard to this issue about whether or not she used someone else's Social Security, got a phony inquiry and all that.
I can't tell you specifically. I can tell you what my responsibilities were, and I can tell you what I had undertaken. I was not involved in the case in Kane County. And the only involvement, as far as Mr. Graviscus was concerned, with the federal lawsuit was he made available his offices because the depositions were taken out in King County because Fermilab and the witnesses were out there. That's the one circumstance. The other circumstance was that he had filed the motions to quash based upon the requests for documentations that he felt were invasions of attorney-client privilege and were a violation of Rule 45. That was the only matter.
Okay.
Are you going to save some time for rebuttal?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Okay.
Mr. Piskorski.
May it please the court, Thomas Piskorski on behalf of defendant Eppley. At page 34 of their opening brief, the plaintiff argues that the district court's decision is unsupported by any actual evidence and without any actual proof. The evidence, in fact, is quite overwhelming and unrebutted. The indisputable telephone record evidence and the witness testimony establishes that the plaintiff took personal information produced in discovery, forged documents using that information in an attempt to obtain payroll records of her supervisor. At pleading number 39, January 6, 2004, plaintiff's motion to quash, the plaintiff says the following, that the time records would have established that Terry Erickson, the supervisor, was not on medical leave when she was. In that document, the plaintiff calls those documents relevant. She was trying to get the documents to assist her in both the summary judgment proceeding and in later proceedings. They put that in their brief. The evidence also establishes that after the forgery was discovered and after we gave the plaintiff a couple of opportunities before filing a motion to explain herself, she then attempted to cover up the misconduct, where just days before her deposition, she disconnects the telephone line from where the forged documents were sent. She failed to disclose that in her deposition, which occurred several days later, and she gives false information to the telephone company about the court's actions with respect to subpoenas. The sufficiency of the evidence argument is weak, in our mind, quite almost frivolous. It is frivolous.
What should they've done once this is exposed? It obviously takes over the case. What is there any curative thing the plaintiff could have done at the outset to get the case on track, or is it forever wounded, do you think?
I think what the plaintiff should have done, if in hindsight, is when the motion is filed, or even before the motion is filed, she should have explained herself to us in form of a letter. And once the motion was filed, the plaintiff should have admitted, yes, I did it, and explain it, and ask for the court to excuse it, forgive it, sanction it in some minimal manner, and let the case proceed. Instead, the plaintiff fought tooth and nail over every part of this case. She refused to admit to anything. She made us go through every single hoop in the case to establish such simple faxes, whose telephone number does that belong to, when did it change. We fought over every single point. The plaintiff took the approach, I'm going to make you prove everything, which is okay, but the right approach would have been, you know what, I did something dumb. And, Your Honor, I'm sorry, sanction me, slap me on the wrist, bar some evidence, monetary sanction, let my case go on. Instead, she adopted a completely different litigation strategy, and the district court described it as stunning. Stunning conduct aimed at preventing the court from inquiring into the matter and determining the facts. They filed 6 motions to dismiss and motions to quash over simple matters as whose telephone number is that? Can I see which telephone numbers were in your house? Another reflective approach on this, during the hearing, when a witness is being asked about the forged document, establishing some foundation, the plaintiff objects on relevance. In the district court, and I need to quote it because it really captures what was going on here, quote, no relevance, my goodness, that's ridiculous. Of course it's relevant. That's why we are here. The bottom line is the plaintiff's original wrongdoing was bad enough and deserving of dismissal and sanctions. The way she responded to it with the cover-up and interference with the court process worsens an already horrible record. A couple of the plaintiff's arguments that I feel the need to address. She attacks the integrity of the court over and over in her brief. Page 32, she accuses the court of displaying no objective fairness. Page 33, engaging in contempt and abuse. Page 33, lacking objectivity. Page 33, engaging in, quote, contemptuous disparagement. Page 33, accuses district court of being prejudiced. The plaintiff commits serious misconduct, in this case, engages in a cover-up, and then attacks the district court for rightfully probing into it.
Will the record tell us if there are any other cases emanating from this case?
Other than the state court lawsuit, Your Honor. Other than that, the record will not reveal any other proceedings associated with this.
Okay.
Well, all of their reaction, obviously digging the hole deeper, but it seems to be now there's fear of criminal prosecution of some kind. And so anything they say, I say they, anything she says or does is going to be some sort of an admission, and so they seem to be sidetracked trying to avoid some criminal prosecution. You gave the remedy, said they should have owned up to it quickly, ask for forgiveness, maybe get some kind of a sanction so they could proceed with the case. It seems the only other alternative they had was just to dismiss the case.
Yeah, they could have done that, Your Honor, sure. I don't want to go outside the record, but conversations like that were had. Instead, the plaintiff, again, I don't mean to belabor it, but it's quite important. If you read the record, every pleading, every hearing, and there were many in front of Judge Gettleman, there were many motion hearings, many status hearings, where Judge Gettleman was imploring the plaintiff, please appreciate the seriousness of this. I'm taking this very seriously. Instead, it was fight and fight and fight and fight.
When was the first time, I'm just curious, you notified the plaintiff that you would seek attorney's fees and costs?
In the
big picture.
In the initial motion to dismiss, we requested any additional relief. In our reply brief in support of the motion to dismiss, Your Honor, we explicitly sought attorney's fees. And that reply brief was filed before the court hearing and before many other court hearings. So
okay. The
plaintiff was on notice from us that we were seeking fees. The district court certainly put the plaintiff on notice from day one that this was a very big deal, and the plaintiff needed to treat it with that seriousness. A couple of other quick points. The plaintiff accuses the district court of denying her due process. I mean, quite frankly, that's almost outrageous. The district court bent over backwards to give the plaintiff every opportunity to deal with this thing. I can't imagine how Judge Gettleman could have handled it more fairly and thoughtfully in terms of doing it right and giving the plaintiff the opportunity to deal with it. Chose not to. on this jurisdiction issue over and over again. I've heard this argument. It's frivolous. The district court had the inherent authority to control the case before it, and if a party to a lawsuit is taking discovery and forging documents, trying to get other information about the case to use in the case, that's certainly the district court's power to deal with. Whether it rises to criminal conduct, that's a different issue, but certainly the district court had the power to deal with it. And this exercise of the Fifth Amendment, absolutely the plaintiff had the right to exercise it. But we had a couple of things. One, we had overwhelming other evidence about the misconduct. And Judge Gettleman did not dismiss the case and impose sanctions because the plaintiff took the Fifth. He drew some adverse inferences from that, which he's entitled to do, but he looked at the overall record, which is quite overwhelming in every respect. And on this Fifth Amendment thing, these cute little arguments where he cites a Fifth Circuit case at page 32, dismissing a plaintiff's complaint because he exercises his privilege against self-incrimination is constitutionally impermissible. He omits the word solely. That was in the court's opinion, dismissing a plaintiff's case solely because. That's not in the quote, in the brief. A key word. And that's the law of this circuit. You can't just dismiss a case because an individual or a party exercise a Fifth Amendment right. You can draw adverse inferences from it. And before you dismiss it, you better have other evidence establishing the underlying wrongdoing. And that's what the district court did here. The stuff about the telephone records, you can't subpoena them, that we're violating the law. We're violating the law by subpoenaing telephone records. That's absurd. Putting aside the waiver that the plaintiff never made this point until late, to argue that telephone records like this can't be subpoenaed in a court proceeding, there's no authority for that. That defies common sense. Now, on the attorney's fees issue, it's reflective of the plaintiff's litigation strategy throughout. Fight and fight and fight, and Judge Gettleman rightfully had enough of it, and he awarded fees for the conduct. He described the arguments at that point as patently frivolous. The bottom line in this case is plaintiff engaged in misconduct, got caught. Tried to cover it up, got caught. Tried to cover it up again through litigation strategy, the district court wouldn't put up with it. This case cries for affirmance and cries for a real declaration that this conduct was unacceptable by everybody on the plaintiff's side. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Doar? About 3 minutes.
Thank you. Counsel referred to the summary judgment motion. As I indicated in my brief, nothing that was potentially obtainable had anything to do with the lawsuit before the Federal District Court, number one. Number two, in my response brief to the motion to dismiss, I advised the trial court that the conduct, although alleged, was potentially improper. I assured the court that there was not going to be anything that was going to affect the proceedings before the trial court. I made that response. That was ignored. The other matter that
you
I find
ignored,
is
ignored. What do you mean? He's supposed to just forget about it, say we're not going to worry about those records from whatever her name was, and we'll just go on?
I was responding to counsel's argument that there was no representation that was made. I represented to the court as an officer of the court that nothing that was ever possible in the motion to dismiss was ever going to affect any of the proceedings before the trial court. I responded and made that representation in my response brief to the motion to dismiss. Second point I would like to address is the argument of the allegations of wrongful conduct. It's interesting that counsel for the defendant points this out. Let's talk about wrongful conduct. Let's talk about the fact that the motion to dismiss had specific statements that were false and were known to be false. The representations of Mr. Gassman, the representations against myself that I did not deny those circumstances, those were false. The affidavit of Rosetta Hicks that had no attachments to it, and the representations and the declaration of Rosetta Hicks that said that the motions to quash had been granted, those were absolutely contradictory. Where does it allow the defendant's counsel on an allegation of a violation that would require the court to exercise inherent authority for it to violate the federal law and submit false documents. Cannot be done. I don't think Chambers in any way authorizes a federal court or any other court to violate the law or allow the violation of the law. So counsel is absolutely throwing rocks while he stands not in a glass house, but without any protection at all. The element of due process in which he says, the element of due process was before the court. I had no right to take discovery once the matter was presented for purposes of the evidentiary hearing. My trial subpoenas were quashed. Is that a standard, a due process standard? It is not. The third element was the court had no right, had no opportunity to amend the motion to dismiss, to have it qualified for purposes of a hearing, and then say, I'm going to make the decisions based upon that without the element of proofs. And that's the circumstances. There aren't any proofs to sustain it. The only thing that could be done was under the threat, under the absolute threat of potential criminal conduct, to force the circumstances in which the plaintiff had to assert the constitutional.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Doar.
Thank you, Your Honors.
The case will be taken under advisement.
Thank you.
We'll proceed with the last case of the morning.